Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Everybody's heard this, right? That during the recession, companies have to do more with less. Well, they are. We learned this morning they're doing a whole bunch more with a whole lot less people. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. SunGard Availability Services operates 5 million square feet of secure data center space dedicated to keeping people and information connected. More information at sunguard.com. And by the Henry Luce Foundation, seeking to increase American understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday, the 5th of November today. Good to have you here. The unemployment number that's going to come out tomorrow morning is going to give us a pretty good snapshot of where the labor market was in the month of October. It's probably safe to expect a higher unemployment rate and fewer jobs in the economy. But there was a number that came out today that speaks volumes about the labor market yet to come. Last quarter, worker productivity grew at its fastest rate in 6 years. The formula for that is pretty simple. It's widgets produced per hour worked. So today's report means that people who still have their jobs are working harder than they used to. That makes up for the people who lost their jobs. But it also spares their employers from having to hire anybody new, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains now from New York.
Remember that famous I Love Lucy scene where Lucy and Ethel have to wrap the bonbons speeding by on the conveyor belt?
If one piece of candy gets past you and into the packing room unwrapped, you're fired.
A minute later, poor performance notwithstanding, the boss says it's time to ramp up productivity.
Fine, you're doing splendidly. Speed it up a little!
Well, that, in a chocolate-covered nutshell, is what companies are doing to the rest of us.
They're asking their existing workers to really step it up.
Mark Zandi is chief economist at MoodysEconomy.com. He says productivity is up not because we're worried we'll be fired if we don't work hard enough. It's that our bosses don't want to hire new people until they're sure the economy really is recovering.
Businesses are just nervous that the demand that they've seen isn't for real, isn't going to be maintained into next year. They're going to wait and see to make sure that it is for real, and then at that point, they'll go out and start hiring again.
But won't companies get used to all this productivity and decide they don't need to hire? Labor relations professor Gary Chason at Clark University says no.
As productivity increases, there'll be economic growth. Companies will expand, and hopefully they'll be able to translate that into jobs.
We'll get an idea of how the nation is doing in job creation when the Labor Department reports October unemployment tomorrow. Chason says if you still have your job and are working yourself to the bone, things may ease a little as the economy recovers, but probably not much. He says companies have gotten a taste of more for less, and they seem to like it. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
This was a big day for endorsements up on Capitol Hill. Both the AARP and the American Medical Association got behind the House Democratic plan for health care reform. The endorsements weren't entirely unexpected. Both groups are going to get pretty much what they want out of the bill. But the going may be rougher for the drug industry. President Obama struck a deal with pharmaceutical makers back in the early days of this debate. The industry agreed to $80 billion in cuts to make the reform package more affordable. Now, though, the House is saying, not so fast. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganser explains the costs of bringing big business to the table.
The House bill would allow the government to negotiate drug prices for Medicare beneficiaries. That would save the government a lot of money, but the drug industry would end up giving back much more than the $80 billion it agreed to in its deal with the White House. Eric Asaroff is a healthcare industry analyst for Concept Capital's Washington Research Group. He thinks drug makers could more than afford it.
I would argue that, that they could probably stand to afford $160 billion.
Asaroff says that's big money that the pharmaceutical industry didn't bargain on paying, and it could be a huge sticking point for drug makers when the House and Senate try to merge their bills.
I don't think that that was a part of the deal that they made with the administration, and I think that as this process goes on, that's going to be a big bone of contention.
But House Democrats don't feel bound by the White House deal, and some are grumbling that the drug industry got too big a break. Jeffrey Joyce teaches economics at USC.
There's a belief that they got off easy, but I think there's some desire on the administration to say, we're going to reward those who come up first and support us at the very early stages with, I guess, more attractive arrangements for their industry.
David Certner lobbies Congress for AARP. He says President Obama remembered how the healthcare industry helped sink the Clinton administration's healthcare overhaul. He realized he might have to compromise.
People have learned from the past and learned from history and have realized that you can't take on the entire healthcare industry. You need to bring them into the discussion, bring them into debate.
And it might cost you. Did the Obama administration give away too much to bring the drug industry to the table? Certner says we won't know that until a final health care overhaul plan has been hammered out. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
As with health care and getting big business on board, so it goes with global warming. The Senate Environment Committee approved the climate change bill today. The final vote was 11-1. That was all Democrats, by the way. Republicans boycotted the vote to protest what they say is a lack of rigorous analysis of the bill. It is not obviously the most bipartisan of atmospheres, so a group of three senators is trying to cobble together a compromise, one that will involve, as I said, big business. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
John Kerry, a Massachusetts Democrat, Lindsey Graham, a South Carolina Republican, and Joe Lieberman, a Connecticut Independent, are the strange bedfellows trying to cut a deal on limiting greenhouse gas pollution. They propose to combine investments in renewable energy with more incentives for oil drilling, clean coal technologies, and nuclear power. Senator Graham says bringing more stakeholders along is the only way a bill will pass.
What I've got to do is convince people in South Carolina and our colleagues up here as a whole that environmental policy will be good business policy.
The three senators have welcomed a pledge of support from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which has been blocking climate change legislation. But some environmental advocates say senators are compromising too much to bring businesses on board. Nick Burning is with Friends of the Earth.
We've already got a bill that gives away a lot to industry. It's already not strong enough in terms of cracking down on pollution. And now there's a new effort to include even more giveaways. The results could really be disastrous.
But Steve Cochran with the Environmental Defense Fund says, like the debate over health care reform, there will be no transition to clean energy or caps on pollution until more interests are included in the negotiations.
There's a lot on the table, but there are a lot of people who come to that table, which is why I'm so encouraged to see Senators Kerry and Graham and Lieberman moving forward with a bipartisan effort to really try to put something together.
Despite those efforts, the Senate will not meet a major goal of the environmental community: approving greenhouse gas reductions before an international global warming summit convenes in Copenhagen next month. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Up on Wall Street, the Dow's biggest day since July bumped the blue chips back over 10,000 today. Details, numbers, later on. In Germany today, thousands of workers at General Motors' European division Opel walked off the job. They say it's the first in a series of what they are calling warning strikes. Labor is trying to pressure GM not to cut jobs. But a couple of days ago, this wasn't GM's problem at all. Things were all wrapped up to sell Opel and Vauxhall in the UK to a Russian and Canadian consortium. The GM board backed out of that deal on Tuesday, hence the strikes. Dave Leggett runs an industry website called JustAuto.com over in the UK. Mr. Leggett, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
These Opel workers in Germany and across Europe, why are they so angry?
They're angry because the deal that they thought was going to protect a lot of their jobs was nixed right at the last minute earlier this week when GM's board decided that it would rather retain its core European operations, Opel Vauxhall, than sell them to a consortium led by Canadian parts manufacturer Magna.
Just to be clear, there probably would have been some layoffs had the deal gone through too, right? Just fewer than if GM is holding on to the company.
That's right, yeah. I mean, everybody knows there's going to have to be restructuring in the European auto industry across the board. But certainly Opel Vauxhall was looking at significant restructuring, whoever was going to be in charge.
German politicians are kind of peeved too. Chancellor Angela Merkel got President Obama on the phone yesterday over this one, didn't she?
Well, she's particularly angry, I think, because so much politically was riding on it for her. I mean, they've just had a general election in Germany, and in the run-up, she made it very clear that she'd help to kind of broker this deal, which would mean fewer job losses or perceived fewer job losses and plant closures in Germany. So she'd kind of put a lot of political stake into this deal, and then to have the rug pulled from under the deal right at the last minute, I think was quite a shock to her and indeed to other politicians in Germany.
You mentioned other politicians. I read Vladimir Putin, the prime minister of Russia, said today that GM was arrogant about this. And obviously, it's never good to make people angry. But how damaging is it, do you think, to General Motors to be perceived this way in some major markets?
Well, I'd be reluctant and hesitant to say it's very damaging, to be honest. Of course, there's a lot of kind of puff in the news at the moment, and you know, Putin in Russia has made these statements. But in reality, he knows as well as other politicians know that you know, when there are big multinational corporations, you don't really want to upset them too much. You want the investment to come to your country. General Motors was investing heavily in Russia, and you know, it still sees Russia as a good long-term bet, which is one of the reasons why it actually has decided to hang on to Opel too. It now keeps control of what it's doing in Russia. It has the bedrock of Chevrolet, which is a global brand, which is growing very, very rapidly in Russia. So, you know, the Russians don't really want to upset future investment.
Finally, what about European car customers? Is this all transparent to them pretty much?
No, not at all. I think European car customers are as confused about what's been going on as anybody else. This is a saga that's been running for 6 months. Essentially, it's been in the news. You know, it'll be in the news for a few more days yet, but when push comes to shove, they'll be looking at, you know, how much is that car? How good is it? You know, can I afford it? It's all the kinds of things that they normally take into account when they buy a car. So I wouldn't attach too much importance to this in terms of how the average consumer feels.
Dave Leggett, he runs an auto industry website called justauto.com. We reached him in London. Mr. Leggett, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Tomorrow's unemployment numbers will give us the big picture. How many people who are looking for a job can't find one? But some people have to look longer and harder than others. Among older Hispanic men, for example, unemployment has tripled in the past couple of years. That's according to a study from the AARP not too long ago. And we could give you more statistics to explain why, or we could let commentator Gustavo Arellano tell us the story of one older Hispanic worker that he knows pretty well.
4 months, 4 meses. That's how long my father hasn't worked. He was a truck driver for over 20 years. A short hauler who took containers 6 days a week from the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles to warehouses across Southern California. One proud troquero, whose pre-dawn to post-sunset shifts gave his family a good working-class life. Dad wasn't laid off so much as phased out. New air quality regulations made his truck obsolete. Papi's 58 years old, so it makes no sense for him to buy another big rig. No trucking company will hire him either. They can choose from thousands of other unemployed, younger troqueros. And his career options are limited. He dropped out of school in fourth grade in Mexico. I've tried everything to find Papi a job. I tweeted about it. I asked my Facebook friends for leads. But really, I can't do much. My work world is one of overeducated white-collar professionals. They have no use for someone like my father. Unless it's as a janitor, or a landscaper, someone to cook our drive-through burritos. My dad says he'll do those jobs. He doesn't care. He wants to work. But me? I won't allow it. Nothing against the fine people in the service sector, but my dad deserves better. He already danced the immigrant shuffle in the 1960s, when he cut carpets in a Hell's Kitchen-esque factory. And don't believe smoking and the bandit. Trucking ain't easy. Papi paid his dues toward the American dream. I don't want to see or even think about dear old dad fighting people half his age for the right to make minimum wage. Yeah, it's pride on my part, but I owe it to him for everything he provided us. I'm dipping into my meager savings to keep him and mom afloat right now, but I'm still looking. Hey, since this commentary is about the job struggles of pops, any of you overeducated listeners in Southern California want to hire a good Mexican? He's 58, but the hardest worker you'll ever meet. Email me.
Gustavo Arellano's column in the Orange County Weekly is called Ask a Mexican. We've put his email address on our website, by the way. It's marketplace.org in case you've got a lead for his dad. And while you're there, take a minute. Try your hand at wrangling the federal budget. Try to fit health care reform in there if you can. Our interactive game is called Budget Hero. Give it a shot, marketplace.org. Coming up, sweet dreams of cold hard cash.
It's just something about it. It's like, you know, years ago when people used to collect stamps when we were kids, it's like a bug. It bites you, and you just can't help yourself.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials jumped 203 points today, a full 2%, closed to 10,005. The NASDAQ added 49 points, about 2.4%, finished at 2105. The S&P 500 picked up 20 points, a little under 2%, finished the day at 1066. Retailers posted better October sales, especially high-end department stores. Investors stocked up on shares of Saks, pushing them up nearly 6%. Rival Nordstrom rang up more than 4% today. Investors also tuned into Sirius XM after the satellite radio service reported better quarterly earnings than a year ago. Shares closed nearly 4% higher. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.53%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. Want to know how to talk money with your tykes, tweens, and teens? Get tips on the Marketplace Money website. And to learn more about your child's financial future, stay tuned for our Marketplace Money's upcoming live show in Portland, Oregon.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at the events for Friday. The Labor Department publishes its unemployment numbers from last month. The Federal Reserve Board releases its consumer credit report for September. And Friday is the 158th birthday of Charles Dow. He's the Dow in Dow Jones and founder of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Kevin Ferguson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. A lot of people who follow sports follow the statistics that go along with them. Not all statistics are created equal, though. A new book about the numbers of soccer points that out. Simon Cooper co-wrote Soccernomics. He says track records can only tell you so much. He says the conventional wisdom is generally wrong, and the stats you really ought to be paying attention to in a global sport like soccer are GDP and population. Simon Cooper, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
This is a book that tests the traditions of the game of soccer against the data of the game of soccer. How did you come up with that premise?
Well, I met Stefan Szymanski, my co-author, in a hotel in Istanbul. We were both giving a talk there at the soccer conference. And I'm a journalist, he's an economist, and we began talking and we both realized we looked at soccer in a similar way, which is that it's a very traditional, hidebound industry run entirely by men who've been in it since they were kids. You know, you're a player and then you become a coach or a manager and you do what you always did because that must be the right way and you don't reflect on it. And we said, well, why not test some of the truths, these eternal truths about soccer against the data and see if they're true? And we found that many of them, of course, weren't.
What are some good examples of that? I mean, what'd you find?
Well, for example, the transfer market where one club buys another player, it's much like trades in American sports, except that you also pay the other club a transfer fee, which can be huge. I mean, it can be $90 million, as in the case of Cristiano Ronaldo. And we found that teams that spend a lot on transfers don't do better than teams that don't. Or this idea that's very strong in England, that England underperform, they should be doing better. It's a disgrace that the country that invented soccer isn't doing better. Well, we drew up a system of testing every country in soccer and see whether they overperformed or underperformed. relative to their resources. And we found that the US, for example, underperforms very, very badly. But in fact, England overperforms. It does better than you'd expect, given its rather small population.
So the theory being, you know, just to take the Americans, our gross domestic product and our population base and all of that mean that we ought to win the World Cup every time.
Well, it's true that your GDP, despite the last year or two, is excellent. Let's not go there. And your population is staggering and keeps growing. It's true that your soccer experience is not that long. I mean, the US went for many decades where they didn't play many games. But certainly, if you add it all together, the US should be doing much, much better than it is. And in fact, we predict in the book that countries like the US, Japan, Australia, countries sort of at the corners of the soccer world are going to improve. I would expect one of those countries, maybe the US, to win a World Cup in the next decade or two.
You spent some time in the beginning of the book talking about Bill James, who is, for those who don't know, an American statistician, I guess you'd call him, who basically brought the art of numbers to baseball and really revolutionized the way general managers think about it. He was the guy who made Michael Lewis's book Moneyball possible, all those statistics that he derives. And while I certainly see the point of, you know, you got to follow the numbers and all this, here's my question about applying economics to the world of sports. Where's the romance? Where's the just watching the game for the sake of the game?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I love watching soccer. I still play every Wednesday night in Paris with some other old men who can't walk properly. But you can be romantic about the game without being completely wide-eyed and irrational about it. It's still interesting to understand how it works, particularly since so much of us who follow sport, we don't actually spend that much of that time watching sport. It's more we're talking about it with friends, we're checking things on the internet. And what sort of got me irritated is so much of what's purveyed is just wrong. It just doesn't chime with the facts. And, you know, I'm sure if you ask Bill James, he'd say he's very romantic about baseball. He loves baseball. And for people who actually are going to go through the blood, sweat, and tears of writing a book like this, like we did, you actually really have to care.
Simon Cooper, he is the author with Stefan Szymanski of Soccernomics, Why England Loses, Why Germany and Brazil Win, and Why the U.S., Japan, Australia, Turkey, and even Iraq are destined to become the kings of the world's most popular sport. Simon, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Going to be a little something different about the coin toss at the Navy Notre Dame football game this weekend. The coin in question will be a special edition silver dollar celebrating the bicentennial of the birth of Louis Braille. The word Braille is going to be written in Braille on the backside of that coin. 400,000 of them were offered for sale last month by the U.S. Mint, and a good number will probably wind up in the hands of collectors. So for a better look at the fascination a lot of us have with pocketing more than our fair share of change, we sent Cash Peters to a coin show.
You wouldn't think there'd be much interest in a money show, would you really? Not now we're switching to debit cards. Unsurprisingly, their PR guy, Jay Beaton, disagrees.
Money's 2,600 years old. We can trace our entire history through money. Everything about our society and our culture, we can trace through our money.
But it's dying out. So how do you feel about that?
I don't know if it's dying out.
I'm predicting the end of your show here.
Oh, I don't think so.
You may be right, too, because the hall was teeming with numismatists, that is to say coin collectors, buzzing around a vast acreage of display cases filled with exciting things like Estonian croons and Filipino treasury certificates. Or how about a bunch of rare American coins?
The value of coins is based on, first of all, how rare are they? The better condition they're in and the rarer they are, combined with other market forces to determine a value.
So if we were to break this case now and just run off?
We'd be shot.
Then I won't be doing that. But because world currencies are constantly changing, they attract hordes of collectors. They have three characteristics. A, most of them are men. B, a lot of them have ponytails. And C, what they do seems incredibly boring to the rest of us. Dealer Sandra Bamer.
A lot of them are not boring, but they are quiet and introverted. They're usually very smart.
Do they have problems getting a date?
Some of them. Some of them don't have any problem with that.
It's the ponytail, isn't it? That's the turn-on. Of course it is. The show had several high points. The British Royal Mint had brought along its new range of coins. They're in colour. It's the latest thing. Meanwhile, the Canadian Mint was bashing out commemorative tokens that were cute but worthless.
and not just because they're Canadian. You see, in my head, this is how Canadians make all their money.
They make them coin by coin,
one at a time.
I think the Winnipeg Mint can strike a million coins a minute or some crazy number like that.
Jeez. There was also a huge display case filled with millions of bucks in old currency. Jay again.
These are $100,000 notes. These were never made for general circulation, but they were made for bank transfers back in the day when you would hire a runner on a bicycle and he'd...
Now, the reason he stopped talking was because all of a sudden this huge guy walks up with a security guard, removes $1 million from the display case and starts posing for photos with it. Hello?
Who is this guy?
That's Hillbilly Jim, wrestler.
Hillbilly Jim the wrestler.
He was a wrestler in like WWF for years and what have you.
No, that Hillbilly Jim, always kidding around. Turns out he's also a serious coin collector. He has the ponytail and everything.
It's just something about it. It's like, years ago when people used to collect stamps when we were kids, it's like a bug. It bites you and you just can't help yourself.
Is that right? Jim, though, was quick with a warning. If you're into collecting coins, do your research. There are rogue dealers out there who will skin you alive. The kind who give numismatism a bad name. And numismatism is a pretty bad name to begin with.
Every once in a while you hear a story about somebody coming in and saying, I don't know if this thing's worth much, and it's just one of a kind coin. And of course, sometimes there have been stories of people letting them slip out of their hands for a little bit of nothing.
Now you see, that's the danger. I was going to ask him a lot more, but the next thing I knew, he was wrestling with some guy from the U.S. Treasury.
Right, and give it back to me. I don't want no IOUs.
Boys. So instead, I went up to one of the dealers and asked, are you a crook? Jack Bayman.
If you polled 10 dealers and you would find maybe 5 out of 10 might try to pull a fast one.
Is this industry riddled with sharks?
Of course. Is the used car business riddled with sharks?
Yeah, but I think that these people kind of look like they might be too educated, intelligent.
I wouldn't say that you're a very good judge of character.
I agree with that.
Story of my life. In Los Angeles, I'm Cash Peters from Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note before we go, the 20th anniversary of the Berlin Wall coming down is next Monday. The Irish rock band U2 gave a concert in Berlin tonight as part of the MTV European Music Awards to mark the occasion right in front of the Brandenburg Gate. 10,000 free tickets were snapped up in just 3 hours last week. One small problem, though. MTV and local promoters put up a 6.5-foot-high steel wall to keep the ticketless out and block their view. So we are going to call that the irony curtain. Makes sense, right? Anyway, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 203 points. That's 2%. The Nasdaq gained 49 points, about 2.4%. The S&P 500 added 20 points, a little under 2% there. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor of the program is George Judson. Coming up next time, forget the horses. What about the people riding them?
When Joe comes back after race, he'll have 3 or 4 kids running up to him for autograph or goggles or whatever, and which they've always had a little bit, but it seems more pronounced now.
Jockeys come to reality TV. Seriously. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.